Welcome back to the Battle of Stalingrad podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 33, and the noose has tightened significantly around the 100,000 or so Germans trapped inside the two small pockets in Stalingrad. General Paulus had moved his headquarters right into the city, as we heard last episode, setting them up in the basement of Stalingrad's department store called the Novomag. That was a multi-story building that overlooked the square of the fallen Soviet heroes. By the late afternoon of the 25th of January, 1943, the Russians had driven a wedge through the middle of the German pocket. At dawn on the 26th of January, ranks of the 21st Army met up at Rodimtsev's 13 Guards Rifle Division north of the Mameyev Kurgan, near the Red October workers' settlements. The scenes were emotional, especially for Chuikov's 62nd Army, which had been fighting virtually on its own for 5 months. Bottles of vodka were passed back and forth, as usual. The Kessel was now split in two, with Paulus and his senior officers bottled up in the smaller southern pocket and General Strecker's 11th Corps in the northern part of the city around the Stalingrad tractor factory. Strecker had only one radio left and no intention of surrendering. At the Central Military Hospital, a mile north of the Univermag, 3,000 German wounded lay under a merciless wind that whipped through the building's shattered walls. There was no medicine, so doctors placed the most gravely wounded on the perimeter so they would die first and quickly, and then their bodies could shelter the others. Around all four sides of the building was a stack of bodies 6 feet high, a macabre kind of frozen human windbreak. Soldiers who arrived from other sectors earned their food by stacking the newly dead on top, almost like railway sleepers. There was a quota to stack before the cook splashed watery soup in their outstretched mess tins. Such is life when all around is death. The Russians spotted this infirmary from hell and decided to mortar the building with incendiaries. The spotters were extremely accurate, and the bombs landed directly on the block. As medics screamed to the wounded to run, the flames were fanned by the high winter wind and raced through the hallways. Wounded hobbled away on fire, then lay dying in the snow, sizzling. Eventually, the entire structure collapsed. When rescuers tried to enter hours later, the stairways were clogged by a chain of blackened corpses. There is much propaganda from both sides about this battle, but the despicable acts were shared, whatever the Russians say now. After all that had gone before, the brutalized citizens tortured and murdered by marauding SS thugs, children bayoneted, women raped and then executed, what did the Germans think was going to happen? Later, some of these Russians would grapple with their demons when they realized how they had turned into animals, by Nazi animals. Two wrongs only make a right when you're seeking revenge. It's later that veterans reflect, then realize they had actually turned into their enemy. Inside the two German pockets, everyone now knew it was over. They were finished. Wounded Germans were asking for pistols to shoot themselves. At the bottom of the ravine west of the Mameyev Kurgan, General Seydlitz Kurzbach was debating suicide with other officers. Only a week earlier, this general had been fervently spreading pro-Nazi propaganda that Hitler would save them. Now he spent his final hours cursing the insanity of the Third Reich and openly advocating revolt. General Pfeiffer was standing nearby and agreed, shouting that he owed nothing to what he called a bohemian corporal skunk. General Otto Korfs joined in, calling for Gotterdammerung and cursing the Nazis. Colonel Krohm withdrew, preferring to read his Bible. General Heitz remained loyal to Paulus and mounted machine guns at the entrance to the Univermag bunker, announcing, "I will shoot the first man who deserts." The officers were yelling and did not see Seydlitz's orderly walk past. A moment later, the elderly man blew himself up with a hand grenade. General Moritz von Reber surrendered with part of the 297th Infantry Division 3 miles west of the mouth of the Tsaritsa River. The Soviet colonel who took his surrender asked, "Where are your regiments?" Von Reber is reported to have said, "Do I really have to explain to you, colonel, where my regiments are?" The surrendering continued. One of the first to go was the chief medical officer of the 6th Army, General Rinaldi. During his interrogation, the Red Army learned of Paulus's state of collapse. General Hans Huber's replacement, General Schlomer, was shot in the thigh. General von Hartmann of the 71st Infantry Division was killed by a sniper bullet through the head. Word filtered through that the Russians had seized southern Stalingrad right up to the Tsaritsa River, and so the commander of the 371st Infantry Division, General Stempel, shot himself. A number of other officers did the same shortly afterwards. Over the next 48 hours, the fighting died down as German and Romanian stragglers, who were mostly wounded and shell-shocked, withdrew into the ever-diminishing southern pocket, along with some men who were still combat-ready. There, at the Univamag department store in Red Square, the last symbol of German occupation, flew from the makeshift flagpole fastened onto the balcony above the main entrance a swastika, an ironic fluttering rag, most would agree. Word then got out to the Russian Don Front headquarters about the number of German officers committing suicide or surrendering. For the first time in this battle, the Soviet propaganda and intelligence staff were spoiled for choice about what to boast about. Russian intelligence captain Dyatlenko was hurried back to interrogate prisoners at the front, mainly top officers. There, he met General Edler von Daniels, commander of the 376th Infantry Division. What Daniels didn't know was that Captain Dyatlenko had taken possession of his war diary. It was found on board a downed German transport plane, along with von Daniels' letters to his wife. Dyatlenko took the good cop approach to the interrogation, as he recognized von Daniels was in a terrible emotional state. "Herr General," said Dyatlenko, "please have your papers back. This is your property, and you can put it in your family archive when you return home after the war." Daniels was so overcome with gratitude that he answered most of the questions until almost midnight. It was now that these officers fell over themselves to impart the strategic information they had because they felt they'd been betrayed, lied to by Hitler. The Wehrmacht's top officers began uttering derogatory remarks about the Nazi regime virtually en masse, while the Russians listening must have wondered about the German morale. "How quickly these fascists sold out their brothers," they said. The officers called Propaganda Minister Goebbels a lame duck and bitterly regretted that the grossly overweight Hermann Göring had not undergone what they called the Stalingrad diet. It was apparent from these interviews that Paulus was close to complete collapse. The Russians were convinced he was virtually a prisoner in his own headquarters, with his Nazi-inclined chief of staff, Schmidt, acting as the de facto commander. There are many, many symbolic moments in this battle. Another was at hand. The 29th of January 1943 was the eve of the 10th anniversary of Hitler's accession to power, and he was about to lose his 6th Army and, by default, his war. From the basement of the Univamag, 6th Army headquarters, or what was left of it, sent a sniveling signal of congratulations. "To the Führer! The 6th Army greet their Führer on the anniversary of your taking power. The swastika flag still flies over Stalingrad. May our struggle be an example to present and future generations never to surrender in hopeless situations so that Germany will be victorious in the end. Hail Mein Führer!" Paulus. It's likely that Paulus did not write this. It was Schmidt, his chief of staff. Still, the grotesque, grovelling tone grated those who knew the truth, including other officers who read the copy. On the 30th of January, the actual anniversary of Hitler's taking power in Germany, Sergeant Albert Pflüger looked past his machine gun at the water fountain opposite his position at the Univamag. It had been a hotspot for firefights, and he'd gunned down many Russians trying to reach it. There was also a line of dead Germans around, cut down as they tried to reach the water. Pflüger was waiting for the speech on the 30th of January, supposedly to be given by Adolf Hitler on the radio. Instead of Hitler's voice at 12 noon German time, it was Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. The obese marshal made a broadcast from the Air Ministry and compared the 6th Army to the Spartans of Thermopylae. Those hunkered down in Stalingrad were infuriated by his general tone. It was Göring, after all, who had lied so convincingly to Hitler about the airlift which led eventually to their imprisonment inside the Kessel. After Göring ended, some Germans around Sergeant Pflüger began to sing the German national anthem, Deutschland über alles, but when that was followed with Horst Wessel, the Nazi party song, one of the sergeant's men jumped forward and smashed the radio with his rifle butt. Some said Göring was delivering their funeral speech. When it was over, it was followed by Bruckner's Fifth Symphony. Some officers back in the basements of Stalingrad said that the suicide of the Jews on the top of Masada may have been a more appropriate comparison than the Spartans at Thermopylae. That was more accurate than they knew, with Hitler supporting the narrative of the 6th Army committing mass suicide led by their courageous commanding officers rather than being imprisoned. So, on the 31st of January, Hitler created 4 new field marshals, including General Paulus. It was the largest group of senior promotions since the victory over France. That was a sleight of hand. Hitler knew that no German field marshal had allowed himself to be captured alive. Paulus may have been psychologically unhinged and physically exhausted, but he was not a complete fool. He immediately guessed that Hitler had presented him with a cup of hemlock, as Anthony Beevor says. He was about to hold his last meeting of officers, where he said to General Pfeiffer that he had no intention of shooting myself for this bohemian corporal. Hitler wanted to create a potent myth. Courageous field marshal fights to the death, clutching a swastika flag about his body. Imagine the artwork for the German propaganda machine using that kind of detail. Meanwhile, General Schmidt, the arch-Nazi and Paulus's chief of staff, was having second thoughts about this whole die for Hitler narrative. Despite threatening all and sundry with execution for their thoughts of capitulation, he was secretly making his own plans. He began having conversations with Colonel Baulu, who had spent many years in Russia during the 1920s. Schmidt also questioned Captain Boris von Neithardt, who was a former Tsarist officer from the Baltic states. Both spoke fluent Russian and knew about life in the Soviet Union. Schmidt wanted to know what living in Russia was like. Paulus's adjutant, Colonel Wilhelm Adam, asked Baulu what Schmidt wanted, and he confirmed the ardent Nazi was asking lots of questions about living in the Soviet Union. By inference, that meant not dying in Stalingrad. Remember, Adam had been wounded by shrapnel earlier, along with Paulus, and believed in the officer honor code. Baulu had told Adam that Schmidt was particularly interested to learn what one had to expect of their soldiers and officers. In Russia, of course. Adam asked Neithardt the same question and realized that Schmidt had no intention of fighting to the death like a good Nazi. Then he saw Schmidt's suitcase all packed and ready to go. Adam was seething with hatred for both the Nazis and Schmidt. Later that afternoon, the Russians had reduced the southern pockets still further, and the German dread and despair rose. During that night, each man was preoccupied with their own thoughts, their painful wounds, frostbite, what was happening at home, their fate. Most officers expected to be executed, and many began removing badges of rank. During the middle of the same night, Russian General Voronov woke up with a start in his izba at the Don Front headquarters. He was in a panic and suddenly thought that General Paulus may try to escape on an aircraft landing on the ice of the Volga River. He leapt up and telephoned the artillery commander, ordering the guns on the east bank to be trained on the ice, just in case. Back in the southern pocket, Paulus was facing his last day in the Univermag basement. Shumilov's 64th Army had secured virtually all of the city center. Ruined buildings had been cleared by hand grenades and flamethrowers. Red Square was then subjected to an intense mortar and artillery bombardment before Russian soldiers moved in on the Univermag department store. The grenadiers above Paulus's basement laid down their weapons. At 7:35 a.m., a signal was sent to Manstein at Army Group Don.
Russians at entrance, we are preparing to surrender.
10 minutes later, Senior Lieutenant Fyodor Ilchenko made his way down the stinking stairs to the packed basement, and another signal went out that read,
"We are surrendering."
Staff officers were sent from Shumilov to discuss the terms of surrender with General Schmidt in the basement. Paulus remained out of sight, leaving the all-important details up to the chief of staff, who'd basically been running the show for the last few weeks anyway. It may have been a ploy to distance himself from actually thinking about surrendering, but it could also be that Paulus was exhausted. Finally, 2 hours later, General Luskin arrived to take Paulus' formal surrender before he, Schmidt, and Adam were taken to Shumilov's headquarters by a staff car. With the 6th Army soldiers left behind in their basements, it was a time of heightened terror. Their immediate lives hung in the balance. Waving submachine guns, the Russians ordered the Germans to throw their weapons in a corner and file out. They'd already prepared for what they knew would be a difficult march by wrapping their boots in cloth. Some Germans shouted, "Hitler kaput!"
And in reply, Russian's Arthur shouted back, Kameraden, krieg kaput, Polis kapitulert.
But mostly, they responded aggressively with,
Fascist or Fritz, komm, komm.
When Soviet troops entered the theater cellars, they gave the order for those who could walk to get outside and march to the prison camp. Those who set off assumed the wounded would be looked after. Instead, Red Army soldiers shot them where they lay. Moments of extreme danger passed with either life or death in an instant. In the NKVD building, a German officer concealed a pistol, then shot the Russian major who took his surrender before shooting himself. The German troops nearby thought they'd all be killed. Somehow, the angry Russian troops allowed this to pass, and the prisoners were spared. The volatility of fate prevailed. Another hospital building was purposefully set alight by the Russians. Two German Luftwaffe officers, who'd been told to go into the building, jumped out the back. When they were confronted by soldiers who were about to shoot them, one of the Germans pulled his pants down in a moment of acute psychology, as Anthony Weaver describes it. The Russians got the joke, burst out laughing, left both to live. But it was the Hueys, or Russians who'd fought with the Germans, who received special treatment from the Red Army. Hundreds were executed. To this day, information about what happened to these thousands of men and women has been kept secret by the Russians. The files of the 10th NKVD Division in Stalingrad remain firmly closed. It is safe to assume they were executed immediately or died in labor camps. It is also known that about 10 groups of Germans tried to break out of the final pocket, but all died. Captives were stripped of watches and rings, cameras, and the Wehrmacht's highly prized mess tins. These gaunt prisoners stumbled out of bunkers and cellars, hands high, some needing help because their feet were in tatters because of frostbite. Many had lost their toes already. They kept their eyes down, trying not to look at the starving civilians who appeared on the streets as if by magic. All around, shots could be heard, some from bunkers. It was wounded Germans receiving the coup de grace. These defeated remnants of the once proud 6th Army, now wrapped in rags with signal cables as belts, were herded into a long column for a long march. The group of survivors from the German 297th Infantry Division was then confronted by a Russian officer who pointed at the shattered ruins of Stalingrad around them and said, "That's how Berlin is going to look." And 2 years later, it did. General, or should I say Field Marshal Paulus, was on his way to the Don Front headquarters outside Zabarenko, 64th Army HQ, in his own staff car, which was an elegant Mercedes, of course. Sitting with him was Lieutenant Lev Bezhminsky of Red Army Intelligence. It was a 50-mile drive, while Schmidt and Adam followed under escort in another car. All the other Stalingrad generals were brought to another izba and were watched by a platoon of Russian soldiers, just in case they decided to make a break for it. It was time for Paulus's interrogation late in the evening. Two NKVD agents had been sent from Moscow to join the party. General Malinin was there, and Colonel Yakimovich, who was a senior staff officer. Then Bezhminsky, who was acting as interpreter, informed Paulus and Schmidt their luggage was going to be searched in case they had forbidden articles. Schmidt yelled, "A German field marshal does not commit suicide with a pair of nail scissors." Paulus waved him away and handed over his shaving kit. Eventually, the main meeting began, and Paulus was taken to Voronov's izba. Voronov was sitting at the table with General Rokossovsky, the front commander, and General Telegin, who was political commissar. The atmosphere was tense in Voronov's izba. Tall, thin, stooping Paulus was clearly very ill. He had dysentery, as we know. His hair was graying. Even his patchy beard was flecked with salt and pepper.
"Herr Colonel General, it is rather late, and you must be tired. We have also been working a lot during the last few days. This is why we will now discuss just one problem, which is urgent."
Paulus butted in.
"Excuse me, but I am not a Colonel General. The day before yesterday, my headquarters received a signal saying that I had been promoted to General Field Marshal."
Voronov and Rokossovsky exchanged glances of ironical amusement, but down to work.
"So, Herr Field Marshal, we are asking you to sign an order addressed to the part of your army which still resists, telling them to surrender to prevent the useless loss of life."
"It would be unworthy of a soldier,"
Paulus burst out.
"Is it possible to say," asked Voronov, that to save the lives of your subordinates is behavior unworthy of a soldier when the commanding officer himself has surrendered? I didn't surrender. I was taken by surprise, declared Paulus.
The Russians were not impressed by Paulus's filibustering. They wanted him to order General Strickler and the remnants of the 6th Division still holding out in the northern pocket to stop fighting. But we must halt mid-interrogation, so to speak, and pick up the rest of the story next week. That will also be the final episode in this Battle of Stalingrad podcast series, and I'll wrap up with some description of the fate of the German southern armies as well. Please look out for the other podcasts I've been doing, including the Anglo-Boer War and Plane Crash Diaries, both of which are available on all fine podcasting platforms. And more news, there are two more podcasts which I'm launching by mid-February 2021. The first is a History of South Africa series, which I've been planning for some years, and I'm hoping that you'll find it fascinating. As you'll hear, there is a direct link between my homeland and all humans in the world today. The second podcast has a military theme. I'm what's known as an ops medic instructor with experience in South African war in Angola. A vet called Harry made contact with me almost 2 years ago and suggested I cover that conflict. After some soul searching, I've decided to go ahead, and South African border wars will begin in mid-February. It's going to be even busier than usual at my house known to visitors as Ramshackle Inn. In the meantime, please rate the podcast on iTunes. If you want to contact me, head off to the website abwarpodcast.com and email me from there, or direct message me on Twitter at Des Latham. Until next, goodbye.